Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Amy Goldstein is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a longtime staff writer at the Washington Post. Her book, Janesville, An American Story, is about the city of Janesville, Wisconsin, whose General Motors plant closed during the Great Recession. Amy talks this hour with Shannon Henry Kleiber, a radio producer for To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Shannon asked Amy to start off by reading from her book, Janesville.
So I'm going to read the first six paragraphs from the prologue of my book. At 7:07 a.m., the last Tahoe reaches the end of the assembly line. Outside, it is still dark, 15 degrees with 33 inches of snow, nearly a December record, piled up and drifting as a stinging wind sweeps across the acres of parking lots. Inside the Janesville assembly plant, the lights are blazing and the crowd is thick. Workers who are about to walk out of the plant into uncertain futures stand alongside pensioned retirees who have walked back in, their chests tight with incredulity and nostalgia. All these GMers have followed the Tahoe as it snakes down the line. They are cheering, hugging, weeping. The final Tahoe is a beauty. It is a black LTZ fully loaded with heated seats, aluminum wheels, a 9-speaker Bose audio system, and a sticker price of $57,745 if it were going to be for sale in this economy in which almost no one anymore wants to buy a fancy General Motors SUV. Five men, including one in a Santa hat, stand in front of the shiny black SUV holding a wide banner, its white spaces crammed with worker signatures. Last vehicle off the Janesville assembly line, the banner says, with a date, December 23rd, 2008. It is destined for the County Historical Society. Television crews from as far away as the Netherlands and Japan have come to fill this moment when the oldest plant of the nation's largest automaker turns out its last. So the closing of the assembly plant 2 days before Christmas is well recorded. This is the story of what happens next. So that's how my book begins.
Wonderful. So, Amy, I was struck by reading Janesville, how it is such a book about the economy, about the recession, but it's beyond the numbers and it's about the people. And you really bring out the reporting through those people's stories. How did you decide to write this book?
Well, I was, after my Nieman Fellowship, when I was lucky enough to have been chosen by Bob to spend a year at Harvard, I came back to the Post to write a very broad social policy beat. And as the Great Recession was beginning, I could get away with a lot in this job. I could do all kinds of things. I started to write just a few stories about what I didn't even know enough at the time to know were called recession effects. Mm-hmm. In other words, what difference it makes on the ground that the economy was really bad. So I did a story, for instance, out of Southwest Florida about people who were falling out of the middle class onto welfare. I just hung out in a welfare office for a few days and found these people who had been small business people or, you know, had perfectly well-ordered lives who were suddenly standing in line to apply for public benefits and were just absolutely shell-shocked. I did a story out of Columbia, South Carolina. South Carolina at the time had the nation's second highest unemployment rate, about the strains on the nonprofit parts of the social safety net, places like food pantries that were just slammed with more clients than they'd ever had, some of whom used to be donors. And again, these people were just shell-shocked. Mm-hmm. And I thought something really profound is changing in this country during this period of the recession. And I started looking at what kinds of journalism I was seeing, and a lot of it was from the macro view. Mm-hmm. It was about the political fights over whether then President, pretty new President Obama's stimulus plan was right or wrong, whether the government should or should not be rescuing banks and automobile manufacturers. But I didn't see much writing about what losing work really did to individual people and to the texture of a perfectly ordinary place. And I just became obsessed with finding a way to tell the story.
That's incredible. How did you choose Janesville? You didn't have a connection to Janesville ahead of time, but it turned out to be, like you said, the microcosm.
So I had never been to Janesville. I didn't know anyone in Janesville. I think I've been in Wisconsin once on a story mm-hmm. in my entire career.
Right.
So this was not a familiar place, but I had heard about Janesville when I was searching for settings for a few of these stories I was doing for the Post. Somebody told me that there was this small southern Wisconsin town that had just lost this huge old auto plant. I didn't go out there at the time because the plant had just closed. And a lot of the people who worked at General Motors itself, as opposed to a lot of other people in the area who then lost jobs, were still getting union benefits, something called subpay.
Mm-hmm.
So the pain hadn't really sunk in yet.
It took a while for that to happen.
To happen. But when I began a few years later to indulge this obsession I mm-hmm. had with finding a way to tell one community's story, it kind of lingered in my mind. And, you know, usually when I'm even picking places to go for a few days for a story for my newspaper, I really do a lot of comparing and contrast, and I make charts. I'm very compulsive about all this.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Janesville just kept, like, saying to me, like, come here. I know, not that anyone there knew me, but, you know, in my mind. So I started really thinking hard about what was so appealing about it. First of all, I knew that I wanted a place that had never before been part of the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
So Flint, Michigan, which some of you are probably familiar with the losses of the auto industry there, mm-hmm. was an old story, and I wanted a place where bad economic times was brand new, and that
mm-hmm.
was true of Janesville. Its assembly plant had started out making tractors just after World War I and started turning out Chevrolets on Valentine's Day of 1923.
Mm.
So for all these decades, mm-hmm. several generations of workers, often families had multiple generations of workers who had been through the plant, it just kept going until it stopped. I also wanted a place that had lost a lot of jobs. Between 2008 and 2009, the county for which Janesville is the county seat lost about 9,000 jobs. About 3,000 of them were GMers.
Mm-hmm.
There were another few thousand people who worked at a lot of supplier companies that had grown up over the years because this big old auto plant was there. And then there were these ripple effects. I mean, mm-hmm. bowling alleys closed because not enough people had...
And daycare centers
yeah. closed. I mean, it just really rippled through the community.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. I also, as I started reading up a little bit about Janesville before ever visiting, realized that it fit pretty nicely into the sweep of U.S. history. Barack Obama, when he was still the U.S. Senator, had given a big economic speech right inside the Janesville Assembly Plant in February of 2008.
Mm.
And I found a YouTube video of that speech in which Obama says, the promise of Janesville is the promise of America.
Mm.
And I thought, ooh, that's good.
Yeah. And that was how many months before?
That's what I was going to say. He also said in that speech, basically, if you do what I, the senator running for president, am recommending, he said, this plant is going to be here for another 100 years.
Wow.
That was February. It closed in December.
Wow. Wow. You know, it was, as I was reading it, all these characters in your book, and it's, you know, when we're writing nonfiction, we're reporting, sometimes you start to think of people as characters because they're so well drawn, and, you know, the social worker and the, you know, the families, the parents who said, you know, you'll be okay if you work for GM. I've always worked for GM. That's what we do. They're telling you their stories, but it's several years later. What were the challenges in listening to people's stories and their memories and then turning that into what really happened in your book?
Well, apart from doing by far the biggest piece of work I'd ever done in my life, which was a challenge in itself, there were a couple of really big challenges. One was I first set foot in Janesville late July of 2011. So you heard when I read a couple paragraphs mm-hmm. of the prologue, the plant closed just before Christmas of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the challenges was going back and reconstructing what had happened and trying to make it feel as vivid in the writing as things that I would then watch with my own eyes for the next few years. Mm-hmm. So that took a little doing.
Yeah.
But another issue was, even when people were trying to be as helpful as they could, people's memories are often pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything, and I wanted this book to sound novelistic. I want it to feel like a story that kind of pulls you through and has emotion to it. But every single thing in it is reported.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't be just like guessing, filling in gaps.
Mm-hmm.
So let me give you one example of how I dealt with these little memory issues. So there's one family, there are three main families of workers in the story. One of them is the Wopat family. And there's an older generation, Marv Wopat, who had just retired from General Motors before his son gets laid off. This was pretty hard on them both because Marv Wopat, who had been kind of a big guy in town, he was the plant's employee assistance head for 25 years. So he knew everybody's dark secrets inside this plant. And he also was kind of a novice politician on the county level at the time this is happening. He feels pretty guilty because he's getting a pension, his son's getting laid off. So one of the things I tried to do was make sure that one of the main people, and you're right, it's funny to say characters when these are people who I know who are to this day
the
living their
people.
Lives
yeah.
in Janesville, Wisconsin, make sure that various ones of these characters are in the different scenes that I'm writing about so you'd feel like it was a continuous story. So there's one kind of touchstone I keep coming back to in the book, which is Labor Fest, which was the Labor Day celebration in Janesville. And there's one year in 2010 when Labor Fest becomes kind of a big political deal. At the United Auto Workers Local 95, that's the local union hall, there was a regional rally called Jobs Now, kind of building up for a national rally in Washington not that long after. And I figured that Marv was the most likely of my characters to have been there, which is good because I need a person whose, you know, story is running through story to be at this moment in time.
Right.
Well, Marv remembered that that fall he had heard the Democratic candidate for governor speaking at the union hall. But there was a little problem because the Democratic candidate for governor spoke at the union hall that fall twice. And Marv could not for the life of him remember which time he'd been there. So I started looking around. I was reading newspaper clippings, didn't tell me everybody who was on the roster that day. But then I found this gold, which was a Facebook video. And I could see who spoke in addition to this candidate. So, and I could go back to Marv and say, did you hear these people or not? And he's like, yeah, those were the people I heard. Bingo, I can put them in the scene.
This is what reporters do, This is how you do real reporting.
Yeah. And,
but you also tell it in such an engaging way too, which I think is, it's great to be able to combine those, and that's why the story works.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Amy Goldstein talks about how Congressman Paul Ryan reacted when he learned that the General Motors plant in his hometown would be closing.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Shannon Henry Kleiber's conversation with journalist Amy Goldstein, author of Janesville, An American Story.
Some of the way you told the story that was so evocative to me was these terrible things that happened, but you described them in these really sad but beautiful ways. And I'm going to ask you about a couple of them. One is the Parker Closet. What was the Parker Closet?
So one of the ideas I had for who should be the people in the book was, in addition to these main families, I wanted the story to feel kind of like a kaleidoscope, so that you were seeing these experiences play out over a period of, turned to be 5 years of the story, from the vantage points of different people in town who in different ways were trying to help figure out what to do. So one of these characters is a social studies teacher named Derry Waylert. And she worked at, still does, at one of the two high schools in town. I say the two high schools in town are named Parker and Craig. Parker is named for Parker Pen Company, which comes from Janesville, Wisconsin. That was its home. Craig was named for the man who persuaded the founding head of General Motors to buy a factory in town. So the industrial identities of, you know, this community are like wired into the identity of these high schools. Okay, that's a digression. Back to Derry Waylert. She's a pretty compassionate woman and knows her students pretty well. And she started to see that some of her kids who had been from middle-class families didn't seem like they were doing very well. They were falling asleep in class. They maybe were hungry. Maybe they didn't have school supplies. So on her own, she goes to the principal and asks whether she can have a storage room, a little storage closet, to create something she calls the Parker Closet, for which she starts collecting donations of used jeans and canned food and pencils and paper. Use prom dresses so girls could afford to have dresses to go to the dance in the spring. And other people start helping her with this. And in terms of the worker families, I wanted to be sure that there was one family through which I could show the experiences of kids coming of age. So in that family, there were these twin girls who I met when they were high school seniors. And one of them told me that Derry Waylert one day introduces her to the Parker Closet. And she was just blown away that this locked room had this stuff inside. She was blown away partly because she instantly understood the generosity behind it, but also is because it was the first time she really understood that if this room existed, other families had to be going through hard times.
She was not alone.
She was not alone, because even though there were all these families in which a parent or two parents had lost their jobs, this was not something the kids were talking about. It was pretty private inside the family.
That's so visual in your book, that closet and what was in it and just how that was going to not only help the kids but let them know that they weren't alone. So living about an hour away from Janesville and Madison, I run into people who talk about that time, and I'm always kind of wondering, you know, if this had been another city, would so many people have stayed? So many people stayed, but went somewhere else. So who were the GM gypsies?
Well, you know, there's a sort of mythology among economists or other thinker people that if jobs, I'm going to get to who the gypsies are in a second, but this is going to lead in a path there. Jobs disappear somewhere, then people should simply uproot and go to where their jobs. And one of many things I learned in Janesville is that that's just not always the case, that people have real attachments to places. It's home. You know, particularly in a community where this kind of work has existed for so long and there are extended families. I mean, the way that you got hired at GM most of the time was you got a chit from somebody who already was in the plant. So it would be a parent handing down to a son or a daughter.
A chit is a reference, basically. So
a reference. It's like there's an opening and you can apply for it. But it was sort of clubby. I mean, you had to know somebody who worked there to have a chance to apply. Not always, but a lot of the time of the plant's existence. So the result is that there are big extended families in town. So to get to the gypsies, you know, there was a big question for everybody who lost their work about, like, what do I do next? And how do I put food on the table? So if you had been at General Motors itself, most of these workers had pretty good seniority. They'd been there a lot of years. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they had transfer rights to other General Motors plants that were still going around the country. These were faraway places, Texas, Kansas City, places here in Michigan, Ohio, Fort Wayne, Indiana. And a lot of people would take these jobs but not move their families. Mm-hmm. They would, you know, come home, depending on how far away they were, on weekends or once a month. And these people call themselves GM Gypsies. And one of the characters in another of the families I write about is a guy named Matt Wopat, who knows a lot of people who are doing this commute and is just sworn that he is not going to do this. He's Marv Wopat's son. Mm-hmm. And he's from a very close-knit family. He doesn't want to leave, but he and his wife, who's working a part-time minimum wage job, get pretty worried about their house payments falling mm-hmm. behind. They've got three daughters, and he starts commuting to Indiana, about 300 miles away. He starts it in March of 2010, leaving on Monday mornings, working through the week, staying in an apartment with another Janesville guy who's also a gypsy, and driving home late on Friday nights, sleeping in his bed for two nights and a little bit of the first night he's home, and then does it all over again. Mm-hmm. He's been doing this now for since 2010, for 8 years, and he's got several more years to go until he's eligible for the kind of pension retirement that his dad's been getting all this
time.
So
that's just what worked out for so many of them and their families, that they would move, the families would stay. Yeah.
Yeah, I know a few people who ultimately had their family join them mm-hmm. where they were working. They tended to be families with really young kids, and mm-hmm. the kids were kind of, I guess you could politely say, unsettled by having a parent far away
right.
during the week.
Right.
And people ultimately moved. I know one family that's living here in Michigan, and they go back to Janesville all the time. It's where mm-hmm. their vacation time is.
Yeah, it's their home.
Yeah, it's their home.
And that is, it. You know, your home is your home. And that was so poignant, too, that they kind of were holding on to that and trying to make it work the way they could. It seems like in a case like this, so many of us would say, well, what about retraining? So many economists would say, people, okay, this job is gone, GM is not there. We need to retrain everyone at GM to do something else. Did that work?
Well, I was really interested in the question of retraining. I mean, it seemed to me that if I was looking at what happens when work goes away, the mm-hmm. sort of sequel question was, not a very distant sequel, was what do we as a society encourage people to do to try to get work back? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it didn't take me more than a heartbeat to understand that retraining is something that is an unusual economic policy that mm-hmm. both Democrats and Republicans espouse. The notion of going back to school and reinventing yourself, I mean, the whole notion of reinvention is this really American mm-hmm. idea.
Right. So
I was interested in looking yeah. at, well, how well was it working in yeah. Janesville? And another of the reasons that I picked Janesville was that I needed a place that had a college that was doing this kind of vocational training. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin has a technical college system that does this kind of work exclusively. And Janesville had one of these colleges called Blackhawk Technical College. So I started hanging out at Blackhawk. This was some of the first work that I did mm-hmm. On this book, talking to factory workers who are going back to school, and the instructors, and the tiny number of counselors, and people who are running this college who are pulling their hair out trying to figure out what to do with this inundation of factory workers mm-hmm. who are coming at them.
Right.
I also kind of exposed my inner nerd as a journalist and worked with a couple of labor economists on a statistical analysis mm-hmm. of what happened to people who had been laid off from something or other in this part of southern Wisconsin around the time of the Great Recession, who either later did or did not go back to school at Black Hawk Tech, and what was their employment situation a few years later. And the results were really sobering. I mean, what we found was that people who had gone back to school by 2011, 2012 were less likely to be working than people who had not gone back to school.
Wow. Isn't that, that's so counterintuitive, isn't
it? It is counterintuitive.
Yeah.
We found that if they were working there, I mean, before the recession, people who lost jobs, who later went back to school, and the ones who didn't, beforehand, they'd both been making about the same average earnings, same average wages. Afterwards, the people who had gone back to school had a bigger pay drop by a lot.
That's incredible. It's discouraging, right?
Well, it's not the kind of common wisdom about job retraining.
Right.
And, you know, the numbers didn't show, I'm going to say us, because I was working with these couple of economists who were better at doing computer runs than I was. The numbers didn't tell us the why, but I did a lot of interviewing and just reading and trying to figure out what might account for this. And, I mean, the first thing to say is I don't think this is an indictment of job retraining all over the place, but I think it does say that if you're trying to train people in a context in which jobs aren't coming back, that's a big reason why these results were so grim. I think it's also possible that people who succeeded at the retraining, which was a minority of people, I mean, two-thirds of the people who went back to school didn't finish their programs, and that's pretty typical of two-year colleges all around the country. So it wasn't like these factory workers were worse than everybody else at trying to be students. But I think it's possible that of people who succeeded and started a new line of work, they were starting at the bottom rung. So if we have been able to look over the next bunch of years to see, did they eventually do better? Some might have. It's hard to know, but that's a possibility.
Yeah, and that again is taking those numbers and pulling out the real story and talking about people, which is so helpful in business stories and economic stories to be able to do that.
Yeah, and let me just say, one of the other characters in the story, when I was talking about this kind of kaleidoscope-like view, is the guy who was the head of the county job center. It was kind of ground zero for where you showed up if you suddenly lost this work that you thought it was going to last your lifetime. And he gave me a lot of important insights. When he and I started talking about the fact that people went back to school and didn't always fare well out of it, it became clear to me that he felt really guilty. That there was a lot of federal money that was pouring into town to help pay for people to go back to school. And he had thought this was a good opportunity. I mean, these factory jobs had paid well for working class jobs. GM had paid $28 an hour at the end. And if you had a couple working those wages, I mean, this supported a very good life. And a lot of people were kind of locked into this work because of the pay, who hated the assembly line. So he thought, well, this is really a chance for people to rethink what they might really want to do. So he started encouraging...
Another chance.
Yeah, a new chance. I mean, this is a very American idea, right? The idea of reinvention. And when he started realizing that people weren't getting jobs, I remember him telling me he felt like these people had been through a double whammy, that, you know, they lost their job, they started on this new course, and it didn't always work out for them. And I think one thing that was very hard for him or anybody else to have anticipated was, if you think about this great recession compared to the last several recessions in the United States, jobs came back much more slowly out of this recession. So the expectation, you go back to school for a year or two and jobs going to be coming back, was a pretty good bet, but it's not what happened.
So speaking of the government and the federal government, but also I'd like to talk about Paul Ryan a little bit. So what was Paul Ryan's involvement in the community during this time?
Well, when I was talking about why I picked Janesville, I left out the Paul Ryan factor. So this is his hometown. And when I was thinking about what might make for an interesting place to write about, it seemed that you've got this conservative politician who had been the congressman since he was 28 years old, and you've got this Democratic-leaning union town that he's from. So I figured there might be something interesting there to look
at. Interesting mix.
You know, a little interesting tent in there. Yeah. Well, this after the prologue, my story begins with Paul Ryan getting a call on his cell phone from the then head of General Motors, giving him a heads up that the next morning there's going to be a public announcement that the plant is going to close. And Paul Ryan, you know, kind of prides himself on having a pretty genial, calm demeanor. And he starts screaming at the guy on the phone. I mean, I interviewed Ryan and he recounted this, saying, pick on a bigger place that's not going to get hurt so much. So he, you know, he is not an advocate of federal earmarks, you know, special money to help, you know, Congress members, communities. He's not a big fan of entitlement spending, you know, public programs to help people when they're hurting. He's more a private sector kind of guy, more a guy who believes that the answer to poverty is having communities kind of turn out their generosity. But Paul Ryan instantly understood what this meant for his hometown. I mean, he had grown up with kids whose parents worked at the plant. Some of his high school buddies had worked at the plant. And he just, he got it. And he was part of a very serious, at the time, bipartisan effort to keep the plant open. Wisconsin had a Democratic governor at the time named Doyle. And Governor Doyle and City of Janesville and the county and the entire congressional delegation from Wisconsin, Democrat and Republican, worked together to try to persuade General Motors to give the Janesville plant a new small car that GM was going to start manufacturing in the United States. And they said, look, we've got a good, strong workforce. Our quality is good. Our, you know, per vehicle production cost is good within the company. Like, give us this car to make. And Janesville, together, Janesville and the state offered what was the biggest economic incentive package Wisconsin had ever offered any company to try to lure them. And it didn't work. You know why it didn't work?
Paul Ryan?
No, Paul Ryan was part of it. Paul Ryan had good relations with the GM leadership.
Oh, they turned it down?
They turned it down because Michigan offered more money.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
And I can see how they were still hoping, because didn't the plant produce something before a long time ago? So there was kind of always that, well, it can come back. We could start making something else.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the things that I started hearing when I first began to visit Janesville was that I was that people were going to be saying, it's just a matter of time till the plant comes back. And I showed up 2.5 years after the plant had closed. And I heard all of this denial. I mean, I'll tell you another Marv Wopat story. I went to his, his one of his granddaughter's high school graduations, Matt Wopat's daughter. And Marv, who's kind of this larger-than-life character, comes riding up on his Harley, gives me a hug, which, I mean, not everybody in town, but this is like Marv's personality, gives me a hug and says, you just wait, plant's going to come back. This was June of 2013.
Wow.
He was still believing it.
Still believing it.
But the reason, I think, why this denial persisted, not everybody was holding out the hope that long, but I think the reason this denial persisted was that, as you say, this plant had always got another product. You know, stop making a car and start making a truck. Stop making a truck, stop making an SUV. You know, it just, that was the life cycle of this plant for just generations.
It reminds me of that, during that time they started having ambassadors of optimism, which when I read that I thought, oh God, that's so sad, because you know what's going to happen and it's so hopeful, but yet, who are those ambassadors of optimism?
Well, as there were groups that were trying to help people who were thrown out of their work, there were also people who were trying to revive the local economy. So this new coalition formed called Rock County 5.0. Rock County is the county for which Janesville is the hub. And it was a local banker and a very wealthy woman from Beloit, the next town south of Janesville, who became the leaders of this coalition. Mm-hmm. And the banker, a woman named Mary Wilmer, she's married, but that was her name at the time, began trying to recruit new businesses to town and persuade ones there to stay. And Mary had these caps printed, ambassadors of optimism, because she was of the view that, if you put on a good face, that would be attractive in trying to woo other employers. Mm-hmm. Now, Mary has a point of view. I mean, that's a decent economic development strategy. But you can imagine how this ambassadors of optimism lingo was sitting with people who were out of work or working part-time and making half of what they had made at General Motors. It struck them as a little insensitive.
Yes, yeah.
So one of the things that I talk about is, what I began to call two Janesvilles, that there mm-hmm. were people who were directly hurt by this job loss and people who weren't. Mm-hmm. And, they coexisted. Janesville had always been, it's not like It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, it's not like Frank Capra, but it had mm-hmm. always been a pretty cohesive community. Mm-hmm. I mean, it were people who were richer and poorer, like any town, but mm-hmm. been a pretty coherent place. But there really started to be more of a socioeconomic schism, and along with that, a political schism. And I think that, I didn't sort of see this as I was like there at first, but I started thinking that this is one more way that Janesville is sort of a metaphor for what has been going on in the country mm-hmm. last period of years when, just the divide is widening.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Shannon Henry Kleiber's conversation with Amy Goldstein. Support for this broadcast provided in part by Becky Thatcher Designs, where you find jewelry to commemorate the landmarks in your life, at their stores in Leland, Harbor Springs, Glen Arbor, and Traverse City, and on the web at BeckyThatcherDesigns.com.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Shannon Henry Kleiber's conversation with Amy Goldstein.
So you came into Janesville as an outsider, and you complete outsider, and you got to know everybody.
Well, not everybody.
Well, you got to know
a lot
of people.
I got a bunch of people. Yeah.
Yeah. And you came out of it really as the town biographer in a lot of ways. You put so much into it, and your research and talking to the real people and understanding their stories and getting their stories right. How did they react to it as the book came out?
Yeah, so I was pretty nervous about that.
Yeah.
And let me just say before I tell you how people reacted that I always thought of Janesville, the community, as one of the story's characters. Mm-hmm. So it was about people, but it was also about the texture of their place.
Right.
I didn't think of myself as the local biographer, mm-hmm. But I did think of the town as something that I wanted to, and the sort of culture of the town and its history as something mm-hmm. that I wanted to portray, as well as the experiences of these individual people within it. So I went back to Janesville a couple weeks after the book came out to give a talk.
And were you nervous about how they would react?
Yeah. You know, I mean, we've both been reporters long enough to understand that, you know, you can try to portray something as clearly as you understand it, but you don't see it the same way that the people you're writing about mm-hmm. may experience it.
Right.
So I had copies of the book sent to most of the people in the story because I wanted them to see what happened before it came out, mm-hmm. you know, just before it came out publicly. And I was quite apprehensive when I went back and spoke at the public mm-hmm. library. And it was, I mean, this is going to sound like really corny, but it was great.
Yeah. Was it because they had a heads up? Was it because, I mean, you portrayed it the way you saw it, and they said, yes, this is the way it is?
Yeah, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who were in the story came out that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a really cold, rainy afternoon at the end of April.
And that's something, you bring out your story, and they're in your audience.
Yeah.
That your characters are right there.
Yeah. I was saying to somebody earlier that I felt kind of like Dorothy back in Oz.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's Derry Waylett and her mom, who I've heard about but not met. You know, it was kind of sweet. And one of the women in one of these three main families asked whether she could sit next to me while I was signing books. Because she just wanted to be part of that.
Yeah.
And I signed books for a really long time that afternoon.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, again, this is going to sound kind of like corny, but I think people felt kind of, I mean, not everything is pretty in this story.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't, and I was concerned that people might be upset that I had portrayed some things that were pretty harsh that happened during these years. I think people felt like I had somehow dignified what they had gone through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you approached it with a lot of genuine curiosity and respect, so that came through.
I tried.
Yeah. So is this a story with an ending, and how did you decide when to end the book?
Yeah, that's a good question. So another of the things that I learned during these years of getting to know people in Janesville is that I think it takes a really long time in many cases for it to begin to become clear whether a community is going to recover mm-hmm. or die. And, you know, I didn't know this because I didn't know anything about Janesville beforehand, mm-hmm. but it turns out this is a pretty resilient place. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about the economic development efforts. And, I mean, this place has been really trying. But it's still not clear whether it's going to become a phoenix or really collapse.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of residual optimism in town. I mean, that was true all along. People were looking for little signs like, oh, you see, we're coming back.
Mm-hmm.
There was less anger in town than I might have anticipated. You know, it wasn't like people were screaming at NAFTA or screaming at General Motors. They mm-hmm. were just more like, how do I put dinner on the table? But in terms of when to end the story, I end it with kind of the next generation rising.
Mm-hmm.
I end it with these twin high school graduations. Happened a couple weekends apart. I felt that that was a moment when you could sort of see who were going to be the workers shifting.
Mm-hmm.
The story is still not over. There have been big things happening lately in mm-hmm. Janesville. One of the political tensions that runs through the story is about whether or not to keep hoping that General Motors will reopen the plant someday.
Mm.
That went on.
Is that possible?
Well, that went on for years because up until a couple years ago, this plant was in this limbo status called standby. At first, it was one of a couple of General Motors plants that were in the standby status. And then for several years, it was the only one. And what that meant was that absolutely nothing was going on inside this plant, but that it was eligible to be opened if so the market demand for General Motors products warranted it. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things I think that fostered all this denial that went on for longer than you might have thought was reasonable. Mm-hmm. So there were people, you know, union people and kind of Democrats who were aligned with them who were like plugging for this plant just to be hanging out there so that General Motors might reopen it. The business leadership really wanted the plant just sold so that it could be redeveloped. Mm-hmm. So just the end of this past year, General Motors did sell the plant. This limbo status ended a couple years ago, so it was officially closed. Mm-hmm. So General Motors could then try to sell it. It's been bought by a company out of St. Louis that specializes in distressed industrial properties. They're at the moment taking down the plant.
Mm-hmm. Physically taking it apart.
Physically demolishing the plant over a period of many months. I haven't seen that, but I'm going to Janesville for the first time in many months, mm-hmm. and a couple days.
Yeah.
And I want to just, I don't know if I'm going to write about it more or mm-hmm. not, but I just feel like after having, I mean, I find it just, I can't imagine this town without this plant. I'm not even from there.
Right.
You know,
right.
But it's so central to what this community is about.
You want to see it happening.
Right. I want to see it happening, yeah.
So do people still buy GM there? I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, you always hear, buy GM. Are the people who live in Janesville still buying GM?
Yeah, so most people had GM vehicles, but I don't think is like as monolithically GM as used to be the case. Mm-hmm. I remember, so while I was doing this research, I had a succession of very generous leaves from the Washington Post, for which I'm exceedingly grateful. Mm-hmm. And for several months of that time, I was based in Madison. I had this unpaid gig at the University of Wisconsin's Institute for Research on Poverty, which, as you know, living in Madison is, you know, about 40 miles from Janesville. So mm-hmm. I just spent a lot. It was easy to drive there. So I didn't drive my car out from Washington to be in Madison. So I rented a car, and it was a Toyota. Mm. And I remember asking mm-hmm. a couple of the people who I was, you know, I thought, whose judgment I really trusted, like, is this going to be a problem for me? And they said, no, not everybody drives GM anymore.
Yeah. So it's a small change, but a big change.
Yeah.
Well, Amy, we have another part that I'd like you to read at the end.
Okay.
As we're wrapping up.
So I think I'm going to read the beginning of a chapter about Matt Wopat's Friday night drives home from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And before I read, I will tell you the answer to a question that I often get asked when I read a little bit about this chapter called Night Drive. Yes, I was in the back seat. Come on, get the hell out of here, a guy shouts as he bursts out the door and speedwalks across the terracotta tiled lobby, barely slowing to slide his ID card through the punch clock. Friday night at the Fort Wayne assembly plant, the end of the work week, the end of second shift, a 9-hour shift today with a lucky hour's overtime. So that's 11:45 p.m. as this guy is shouting, one guy among 1,100 GMers pouring off the factory floor to start their weekend. Amid this horde, Matt Wopat reaches the lobby at 11:47 p.m., wearing a knit cap, a backpack slung over one shoulder. He is not running, but he too is walking very, very fast, a Friday night ritual. He reaches the chilly night air, and a co-worker wishes him a safe drive tonight. He stops for an instant at the 97 Saturn, which he parks in the same part of the vast lot every Friday, in a middle row under a street lamp, so he won't have to think about where he's left his car when he returns on Monday. He pulls his duffel from the trunk and continues walking very, very fast over to 2003 Pontiac Grand Prix, already idling. In the driver's seat is Chris Aldrich. In the back seat, his coat scrunched up between him and the door, is Paul Sheridan, Janesville GM Gypsies both. Chris pops the trunk for Matt to toss his duffel inside and slam the trunk shut before he gets in on the passenger side, Matt's door is barely closed when Chris guns the engine and roars off. 280 miles to go, 4 hours and 35 minutes speeding just a little, where they're pretty sure they will not get caught. Matt pulls out his phone, calls Darcy, that's his wife, and tell her they are leaving, same as he does every week. When Chris guns the engines, 11:54 p.m. in Fort Wayne, except that Matt is not the only one who stays on Janesville time, so the dashboard clock on the Grand Prix says 10:54. Chris started working at Fort Wayne on August 17, 2009, 7 months before Matt. Chris will never forget that day. His wife and kids along to help him move, except he doesn't like to say he has moved, so he says that he stays in Fort Wayne. Anyhow, his family left on Monday morning when he went to the plant for orientation, which was during first shift, so he was back in this new apartment by 3:30 that afternoon, and he sat on a chair from a cheap dinette set they'd just gotten, staring at a wall. Alone, his wife and kids already back in Janesville, one of the worst feelings of his life. That was 3.5 years ago. The Grand Prix had 47,000 miles on it. Now it has 134,407. On this night, they are not yet 10 minutes from the plant, about to turn on to Route 114, when Matt says in his quiet way, "This is my 3-year anniversary." Chris doesn't miss a beat. "We aren't going to celebrate that," he shoots back. Matt already had texted Darcy before going to work, "Happy anniversary to me, 3 years." And the reply came back, "Has it been 3 years? Seems a lot longer." Darcy had added a sad-faced emoticon.
Thank you so much for coming. This is Amy Goldstein.
That was Amy Goldstein talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber. Amy Goldstein's book is called Janesville, An American Story. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.